Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a jury ruled that a South Florida hospital acted appropriately when it deported Luis Alberto Jimenez, an undocumented worker with a severe brain injury, back to his native Guatemala against the wishes of his guardian. The federal government helps hospitals cover emergency care for uninsured patients, but not long-term care for undocumented workers. This hour, On Point, uninsured immigrants, hospitals strapped for cash, and a far-reaching deportation case in Florida. You can join the conversation. What is America's obligation to uninsured immigrants, often not in the country legally, who need long-term care? And, of course, you can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Deborah Sontag, a reporter for The New York Times who's been covering the deportation of immigrants from U.S. hospitals. Hello, Deborah.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks. And I remember when you first introduced us to this story about a year ago, as I recall, and it was one of these mesmerizing stories. You actually followed the case of this man, Luis Jimenez, all the way back to Guatemala, where he lived on a remote mountain village. Tell us a little bit about him and how this came to your attention and why it has proved to be such a pivotal case.
It came to my attention flukishly. I kind of tripped over an old story in the New York Times archives, which was written when Luis Alberto Jimenez was essentially living in a hospital in Martin County in Florida after, recovering, after his life was saved by the hospital. And the hospital was saying, what do we do with him now? Because mm-hmm. there is no nursing home in this country that will take him. There's no rehabilitation hospital that will take him. We're obligated under federal law to discharge him to an appropriate facility. We don't know what to do next. We've asked the government for help, and the government won't give us help. What do we do? And the New York Times had written a small story at that time, and then, you know, in the way these things happen, it wasn't followed up. And I just sort of tripped across it in our archives mm-hmm. and decided
and just
to
And just to frame him a little further, he was a mm-hmm. young man, actually a Mayan Indian, who had been involved in a car crash, right?
Yes, exactly. He had, you know, journeyed north like so many others to, you know, with modest aspirations to get a job as a gardener and send home money to his wife and two sons in Guatemala. He was living with a cousin in Indiantown in Martin County, working as a gardener indeed, and one day coming home from work, a drunk driver, an American with a criminal record, crashed into the car carrying Jimenez and his compatriots and killed one of them and severely, devastatingly injured Luis Jimenez.
Mm-hmm. And so you were aware that the hospital, after several years of caring for this man, was now threatening or saying that it just couldn't do it any longer and he needed to be sent home.
At the point at which I came into the story, he was already back in Guatemala.
Right.
The hospital, it's a long and complex story, but essentially he was in a coma for maybe 14 months. He came out of the coma and actually had some cognitive ability. And at that point, he needed traumatic brain injury rehabilitation. He was probably a good candidate for such rehabilitation. But the hospital could not find a facility to accept him and give him that rehabilitation, and it did not have those services available in-house.
Mm-hmm.
And so it figured that the best thing it could do would be to kind of keep him there as a boarder and try to find a way to send him back to his homeland, where he would not get that treatment, but, you know, where he would not be in an acute care hospital where he did not belong.
So what efforts, if any, did the hospital make to avoid sending him back? Or was it always a foregone conclusion that sooner or later he would be?
Well, they tried to find there are charity hospitals in this country. There is a, you know, there are places to care for individuals like this, but there are a few. I think what happened was the hospital named his cousin to be his guardian, got his cousin appointed as his guardian, and his cousin, also a Guatemalan immigrant, had a lawyer, a guardianship lawyer, and the lawyer took the position that it would be more cost-effective for the hospital to pay for his rehabilitation in a rehabilitation facility than to keep him in a hospital where daily costs of maintenance are very, very high. And so, you know, while the legal suit was playing itself out, that the hospital had an obligation to try and provide him the kind of rehabilitation that could make him more functional and therefore could make the dynamics of this less intense. That, you know, if at the other end of rehabilitation he had better ability to care for himself, then sending him back to his homeland would be a different proposition. Maybe relatives could care for him here, et cetera. But the hospital didn't want to set a precedent. It didn't want to take out its checkbook, as its in-house lawyer told me, and write a check for how long? You know, for 5 years, for 10 years, for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took the position that it would, you know, rather kind of keep him there, even though the daily cost would be higher to them, than to set the precedent of paying for his rehabilitation.
And so what happened? One day the cousin comes to find Luis at the hospital and he's gone? He's been shipped back to Guatemala in the middle of the night?
Well, yes, but taking a step back from that, the hospital, you know, went to court. They wanted the cover of a judge's permission to send him back. And they got it from a state judge. His lawyer, since state judges don't oversee federal immigration matters, it would later be found that the judge had overstepped his jurisdiction, and the guardianship lawyer found that evident right at that moment and moved immediately to file an appeal. He asked the local judge, the state judge, to issue a stay, to ask the hospital to hold off on deporting Luis until an appeal worked itself out. Instead, you know, while this matter of whether there would be a stay was pending, you know, sort of mm-hmm. early one morning, the hospital chartered a plane for $30,000, put Luis Jimenez on the plane with a nurse from the hospital, and sent him to Guatemala City.
So without consultation with the family, he was sent back.
Not only without consultation, but against their will, because they had staunchly said they did not want this to happen.
Now, you went to Guatemala to find him. It was a remarkable trip. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, I sort of wanted to trace out all of the claims. Often in these stories, you know, so much is said and, you know, not examined. And so I went, you know, deep into remote Guatemala with some colleagues, and you had to drive north from Guatemala City to the provincial city of Huehuetenango, and then kind of over this enormous mountain range, the largest mountain range in Central America, to a village. And then from the village, there's no more road. You know, we took a modest heart-pounding hike up to this one-room house where Luis Jimenez is living with his very elderly mother.
And how was he being cared for, Luis Jimenez?
She, who is a toothless 73-year-old lovely woman who doesn't speak Spanish, she only speaks her native dialect of Concobal, had been, you know, lovingly caring for him, which meant washing him, changing his adult diaper, feeding him on her, you know, tortillas and eggs, and spending time with him. But she is frail. She probably weighs 85 pounds and cannot take him in and out of his bed into a wheelchair. And so she has to wait for relatives to hike in from nearby towns to help her do that. And I asked her if he'd had any medication since he'd been returned, because he suffers
And it would seem that we may have just lost Deborah Sontag of The New York Times, and we will get her back. Let's take a call. Marcus is calling from Blythewood, South Carolina. Marcus?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. So what is your position from what you understand thus far of the case of Luis Jimenez?
Well, I'm not trying to be mean in any way, but I think the hospital did the right thing by sending that person back.
So you say that it's not our responsibility or obligation?
No, I don't think it's our responsibility to take on bills that we don't have to take on, especially for an illegal person in the state.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that you've observed personally in South Carolina, Marcus? Is this something you've seen in South Carolina?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. More so than often, like at the hospital, sometimes it's a, most of the time it's a line of people and they're getting services and I'm like, golly.
Well, thank you, Marcus. We'll be exploring those kinds of opinions in the rest of our show. We're talking about hospitals deporting patients who are here illegally. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about hospitals deporting patients. And joining me now from San Francisco is Robert Margolin, a physician in San Francisco. He brought the subject of forced deportations before the California Medical Association and got the association to denounce the practice. And with us now from New York is Adam Gurvich, a consultant with the National Immigration Law Center, where he focuses on health reform and health equity. And he's the former director of health advocacy at the New York Immigration Coalition. Adam, let's turn to you. This is a case we want to say that is really a benchmark case, the case that we were talking about with Deborah Sontag, because players on both sides really wanted to see what would happen in the case of Luis Jimenez, correct?
Yeah, that's right. But before jumping in, I just want to address the way that this piece was introduced today. I'm not an attorney and I'm not an expert on the decision, but I don't think it's accurate to say that the court decided that the hospital acted appropriately when deporting a patient. That's not what this latest judgment was about. The jury recently decided not to award monetary damages that would have allowed the patient, Luis, to afford health care in Guatemala, where the hospital had sent him to die. So that's what this latest decision was about. It was mm-hmm. about awarding damages. The courts in Florida have ruled that the hospital did the wrong thing, that hospitals are required to develop an appropriate discharge plan. They're not permitted to dump patients. They're not permitted to put people on planes and send them without their consent to another country. So in all of those major aspects of the case, the courts have found that the hospital did the wrong thing. So I just don't want to leave that wrong impression out there.
Well, I'm fine with your correcting that characterization. I think that was actually taken straight from Deborah's story. But still, in any event, the hospital will not have to pay damages here. What kind of precedent do you think it sets? Do you think it'll be appealed? I mean, there are many other cases outstanding like this, correct?
I'm not sure how many people actually bring cases for monetary damage against the hospital once they've been sent out of the country.
I meant people being deported by hospitals around the country. This is a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a problem, and it's important to understand all the sides of the issue. So the hospitals are required by law to treat any of us who get injured or need emergency medical care. We all have the right to that care. Hospitals aren't allowed to look first at whether we have insurance or can pay for care out of pocket or have a particular immigration status. So they have a duty to treat, and they have a duty to stabilize us and not to discharge a patient unless they can confirm that that patient's going to get an appropriate level of care after leaving the hospital. So there's the requirement placed on hospitals. The federal government has stepped in and said, well, federal government won't allow immigrants who are here legally who have green cards for less than 5 years. The federal government won't pay for those folks to have Medicaid, even though they pay the same taxes as citizens. They're barred from Medicaid. The federal government says the same thing about individuals who are here without immigration status. They're not allowed to use Medicaid. So the government says, well, hospitals are required to treat these folks. The federal government, will reimburse hospitals for some of the costs of emergency care. So there's emergency Medicaid, which is the same sort of setup as, you know, any citizen would get if they're low income enough and they meet all the other Medicaid requirements. The government steps in to pay for that care when there's no other source of reimbursement. So that's the situation. The problem here is that emergency Medicaid won't cover the care that an individual needs once they're stable and they need to be discharged out into the community. And so hospitals are stuck warehousing people, and it's not good for the patient. The individual doesn't need that level of care. They don't need to be in an acute care facility. They should be in a less restrictive environment, oftentimes at home in the community. All they need is some outpatient medical care. And because there's no source of payment, hospitals are in a bind.
We've got Deborah Sontag, the New York Times reporter who's been following this case, back on the line with us now. And Deborah, do you think this is a turning point? While you were gone, Adam was making the point that the hospital wasn't so much found to be acting appropriately in this case as it was found that it didn't need to pay damages in a lawsuit started by the Jimenez family. What do you think? I mean, what do you think is the signal being sent to other people in this situation? And how common is this, deporting people who need long-term care?
Well, those are a lot of questions, so I'm going to try and deconstruct a little bit. I just want to respond to what I believe it was Adam was saying a moment ago about the costs that the hospitals bear. In the case of Luis Jimenez
and Martin Memorial Medical Center in Stuart, Florida,
the hospital received $80,000 in emergency Medicaid money that covered some part of the first maybe 2 days that he was there. I think, a few days and you know many surgeries and all of that, but they got $80,000 and they say that they spent $1.5 million to care for him.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be put in a context of the funds that the hospitals receive in general. You know, maybe half of the operating revenues of this particular hospital, I think it's 45%, come from Medicaid and Medicare funds, which are, you know, federal funds. And they are a not-for-profit tax-exempt hospital, which is required to provide some amount of charity care to the community. What is tricky in these cases is that in some places, the hospitals define their community based on citizenship status, on immigration status. They say, if we take care of these people, we won't have enough money left over to provide for our community being the people who were born here and the people who are you know, long-standing members of our community. In other places like New York City and in California, that distinction is not made.
Mm-hmm. So there isn't a comprehensive policy, obviously.
No, it's very, very haphazard. Returning to your question about, you know, what this case found, you know, is the hospital liable for what it did? This was a personal injury lawsuit, essentially. It was a civil suit. Prior to this, there was a case in court that, in fact, found that the hospital acted inappropriately, that that the state court who gave it permission to send Mr. Jimenez back to Guatemala had overstepped its jurisdiction, that in fact the hospital did not have the kind of discharge plan that is required under federal law, which theoretically ensures that patients are being discharged to the next appropriate level of care. It has to be fleshed out. Who are they going to? Who's the doctor who will oversee them? What kind of care will they get? Has to be ascertained by the hospital. These burdens are put on the hospital in exchange for receiving the Medicaid and Medicare funds that help them survive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in this case, it was found that the hospital unlawfully detained and deprived of his liberty, this individual, and without knowing precisely where they were sending him and to what kind of care, and, you know, they shouldn't have done it. That's what the Florida Appeals Court found. And that is the precedent that was essentially established for other hospitals across the country, although they're not bound by it. It's pretty much the only ruling on this matter. This particular case that concluded this week was, you know, a small town setting for a big picture issue in which a small town jury, that was all white, I must say, in a county that is 10% Hispanic, found that the hospital shouldn't have to pay any more than it's already paid. I mean, that's essentially what they found. That just despite everything, you know, the hospital had, the jury didn't talk, so I don't know what they felt. Mm-hmm. But, you know, clearly it's a very, very complicated issue. There are many cases in which hospitals act in a far more egregious and aggressive manner towards undocumented immigrant patients. This hospital cared for him for years, and then, you know, I suppose as the appeals court said, did the wrong thing. But at the last, you know, when it was exhausted.
Right. Well, you in your reporting, you did look at some other cases around the country from Arizona and California that were, shall we say, dubious compared to the case in Florida.
Yeah, I think they're all somewhat dubious in that, you know, it's sort of put on the burden of dealing with these cases which show up the failures of the healthcare and the immigration systems is left on the shoulders of these hospitals, big and small. And, you know, they're human. They don't have any resources. They don't have any guidance. They don't have any oversight. And, you know, in many cases, the hospitals do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, they just do not.
Well, let's bring in Robert Margolin. He's a physician at California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco who's looked at this. And Rob Margolin, you're getting the American Medical Association to commission a study on this issue due out in November. Obviously, this is of great concern to doctors and hospitals.
Yes, Jackie, thank you for having me. When I first heard about this case, it was from reading Deborah's article in the New York Times, and I was shocked to hear the hospitals were doing this. As physicians, of course, we're more focused just on patient care and doing the right thing and sort of free from the financial burdens of hospitals directly, and we certainly understand the hospital's plight here, as well described by Adam and Deborah. I want to say one thing further is they both clearly mentioned the issue of the hospital's requirement to provide free care for patients who need it, as well as making sure that they have good follow-up of care. The third point that hospitals have to do is that they can't do anything without consent. We can't do things to patients without their specific consent or their guardian's consent. And what's so egregious about this is doing something explicitly against the request of this patient's guardian. So when I heard about this case, I thought that the physicians should be weighing in on this, and they brought this to the California Medical Association, and who clearly we all agreed that this was an inappropriate thing for hospitals to be doing. We then brought it to the American Medical Association, where a study is being undergone now. It's such a complicated issue. It's already been explained how difficult it is for hospitals to deal with this burden of care. But we as a society, you have to figure out what to do with these patients. It's inappropriate and wrong to be caring for them this way. Deborah mentioned the fact that this hospital is a pretty complicated case in Florida, and that the hospital had given so much care to this patient and had brought him back from such a devastating illness and had spent so much money for him. There are other hospitals, such as some in Arizona that Deborah described in her articles, that are doing really egregious things where it's really a systematic plan for them that as soon as someone gets admitted, within a couple of days, even way before they're stabilized, they're already making plans to get them sent out of the country and have sent people out of the country who are very, very unstable and a very dangerous situation for them. Clearly, that's wrong. There are other situations in which hospitals have found systems that sort of work where they'll actually pay to get a patient sent back to Mexico to get reasonably good care while they're in Mexico until they can get insurance from the Mexican government to get ongoing care. So there's a whole range of activities that hospitals are trying to do to handle the situation. And that's also mentioned there. Each state does it differently. California does allow Medicaid benefits to people. They don't have to wait 5 years. But even then, it's very difficult to find places to discharge patients who need long-term care. So hospitals are a real major problem, a difficulty, but we have to do the right thing for our patients, I think.
For anybody, perhaps for you, Adam, what should be done about covering the costs when these illegal immigrants cannot pay and have no prospect of returning? Sometimes families don't want them back. Sometimes it's unclear where they've even originated from. So they're stuck.
Right. Well, turning healthcare providers into agents of deportation is not the solution. We've seen cases of hospitals trying to send or sending people out of the country who are actually U.S. citizens, who are lawful permanent residents. So, you know, hospitals are not the right are not in the position to understand people's complicated immigration
statuses. You're saying we're making them the arbiters here, and that shouldn't be a burden that they have to accept. Who should go?
It's completely inappropriate. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a system, we have an immigration enforcement system in this country. That's a separate question. We also have courts that look at any of us who, you know, do we want, if we have an outstanding parking ticket or we owe library fees or we owe child support, do we want the hospital checking up on us and then sending us into the various systems to punish us? That's just not the role we see for healthcare providers in this country, I think. Many of us share a vision of thinking that everyone who's in this country, people who live here, who work here, who study here, should have the opportunity to get quality, affordable health care. Mm-hmm. And what would have prevented this situation, we wouldn't be here talking about it if Luis had had the opportunity to purchase health care he could afford. There's a big discussion going on in this country right now about what to do around health care. And what's really disappointing and quite outrageous is that both the House and the Senate, not only are they not contemplating allowing immigrants who are here, who may be working, who don't have status, to purchase health care they can afford, they're considering not allowing legal immigrants, people who are here with green cards, to be able to get subsidies, even though they would be paying the exact same sorts of taxes that members of Congress pay or that citizens pay. So the solution really should involve allowing people to pay their fair share, mm-hmm. to have the opportunity to purchase health care they can afford. And we need government to step up and play its role if there's an individual who doesn't have insurance.
Okay. Well, let me ask Deborah. It's really not fair, Deborah. We're going to have to come back to you, I think, in the next part of the show. But I wanted you to comment a little bit more on the implications of this case. You had something you wanted to say.
What I wanted to say is that the debate about how to include undocumented immigrants and legal immigrants in the healthcare reform plans, it covers their entire healthcare needs. The cases that I looked at involved catastrophically injured individuals who were in this country working as part of the economy in the way that it has been set up. They're relatively rare cases, and in fact, they could be considered humanitarian cases. So while it seems so mind-boggling to tackle the entire enormous system of immigration and healthcare reform, I just wonder if there is a way to create some sort of special terms for these catastrophic cases.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about hospitals deporting patients. And we've been talking with Robert Margolin, a physician in San Francisco. He brought the subject of forced deportations before the California Medical Association and got the association to denounce them. We're also joined by Adam Gervich, a consultant with the National Immigration Law Center, where he focuses on health reform and health equity. And for all of you, isn't this a case in which we really have to balance what hospitals can do with perhaps a moral obligation beyond the legal obligation, with the need to balance the books with what our own conscience says about the kinds of dilemmas that we may be sending these people back to?
Yeah, I completely agree.
This is Rob Margolin in San Francisco.
Rob Margolin. We have to do something to help hospitals, and I think that the fragmented healthcare system in which we live right now just doesn't allow us to come up with a unified plan. it's so complicated as to what cases recover and so forth. And I think that the idea that Deborah alluded to about some kind of fund, some kind of system which we could tap into, a fund for patients to be cared for, is really mandatory here. And to allow hospitals to be in charge of this and but bear the incredible costs associated with this. I mean, we have a lot of hospitals who are in real trouble right now. Many of them are closing. Our economy is difficult. And when hospitals get into trouble, what they try to do is just see more patients and try to raise revenues. And that really doesn't, and that just doesn't work in this situation. So we have situations where hospitals are really in trouble, unable to provide the kind of care they need for the general population, just spending millions of dollars on undocumented workers, even documented workers who are just very sick. Yeah, it really puts them in a bind. So
let's address a question. Let's address a question, Rob, since you work with hospitals that a lot of our online viewers are asking and a lot of our callers. Why wasn't the driver in the case of Luis Jimenez, why wasn't he responsible or his insurance responsible for covering the health care costs of the victim? Deborah?
Can I answer that?
Yes.
The driver was indicted and convicted of, pleaded guilty to DUI manslaughter. He was a ne'er-do-well with a criminal record who was in and out of law enforcement detention, who was driving a stolen car and, uninsured for the stolen car.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah, so most people just don't have either the resources nor the insurance, personal insurance, to cover the millions of dollars in liability exposure. So there's just no money there to be taken.
And, Deborah, you were saying just before the break that where push comes to shove in a lot of these cases is when the injury or health problem is catastrophic and there isn't, and that's where these things really become acute.
Yes, the real challenge for hospital are the severely injured or severely ill uninsured immigrant patients who are not covered by the government. People with, terminal cancer, with, severe traumatic brain injuries. Most of the cases that I took a look at involved young men who were workers who had serious accidents. And, there are cases where the accidents occur on the job where there's a workers' compensation claim that can be made.
Mm-hmm.
But those are few and far between.
Well, since we're still shaping health policy we don't know just when we'll come out on that, and Adam had mentioned some of the considerations still being discussed, let's take some calls from our callers and see what they have to say about this. Walter is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hello there, Walter.
Jackie, hello there. I have been a citizen of the United States for a number of years, but I was brought to this country by missionaries legally as a foreign student. And similar to Mr. Jimenez, I also had an accident. It was a drunken driver that broke my neck. While it's good to hear the compassion of the various parties that's talking on your program now, but I absolutely think there are two other parties that need to be held responsible. I think we are a Christian nation based on absolute compassion, and that's fantastic, but we simply cannot.
Well, may I just challenge that and say let's be a nation based on compassion. But go ahead and make your point.
That's fine. My point is this, that I think the gentleman who committed the accident, the drunken driver, should be held responsible. It doesn't matter if he's in jail or wherever. He needs to take care of Mr. Jimenez in that remote Guatemalan village.
Uh-huh.
If he has to work in the prison to send him $100 a month, that goes a long way down there for that old mother in getting help.
All right. Well, thank you, Walter. That's an interesting concept. Do you think something like that good work, Adam or Robert or Deborah?
I think we want something a little more systematic. So we want hospitals to be able to treat patients, and we want those individuals to be able to return to the community and lead productive lives. So, you know, what might make sense is looking at the emergency Medicaid resources that the federal government makes available to see if there's a way for reimbursement for some home-based care or rehabilitative care so that hospitals can discharge patients, and the sorts of skilled nursing facilities or home health agencies that could help in Luis's case and in other cases would be able to take on these patients and provide them the care they need so that they can get rehabilitated and go back to work eventually.
Mm-hmm. Which some of these cases, we should point out, people do get better. Because they do get therapies, even in cases of brain trauma. I just want to make the point that not everybody is chronic, Deborah, right? I mean, not everyone is as incapacitated as Luis.
No. I mean, there is a serious subcategory of individuals who suffer serious injuries. And, you know, we do not know whether Luis would have been rehabilitated if he had been given rehabilitation,
right?
To a certain level of functioning.
He was actually able to read something when you reached him in Guatemala, to your amazement.
Yeah, I was shocked. You know, that someone who was he was basically sitting in a bed, with no apparent capacity to track conversation or even to, you know, to talk much. And at the very end of a very long visit, I was reading him a letter that had been written to him by his cousin, and he grabbed it out of my hands and read it aloud himself. And I thought, wow, you know, and doctors that, you know, reviewed his case at my request said that alone was a sign that, you know, there was something to tap into there to be rehabilitated.
It's a very poignant moment in your reporting.
That's just for such a tragedy. Here's someone who seems like he did have some significant rehab potential. A gentleman who was seizing two or three times a day because he didn't have his seizure medications, which could have easily handled this. So clearly he was getting such substandard medical care, it really was heartbreaking to hear.
Yeah. And Bob is calling from Stuart, Florida. And let's say hello to Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Stuart, Florida is in Martin County, Florida, where this accident and so forth occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And with all due respect, I think we're kind of getting lost in a fog here. Let me point out that the local hospitals in Martin County are so overcrowded with immigrants every morning waiting in line for the free services there that we recently, and this is a fact, I'm surprised it wasn't mentioned earlier, we had a woman, an elderly woman, expire in the waiting room while she was queued up to see a doctor in the waiting room. I mean, this is, you're talking about perhaps finding a way for the new healthcare program to handle immigrants. I read in the New York Times every morning that there doesn't seem to be any way for the new healthcare program to be funded for American citizens. It seems to me that while all of the compassion and all the rest of it is absolutely warranted, the facts of the matter are that the hospitals locally, the courts locally, and even the states are being made fall guys for the United States government, who has an immigration policy, has immigration laws, and completely ignore them.
Okay. Thank you very much for making that point, Bob. We'll come back to that in a moment. And let's take another call from Teresa, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hello, Teresa.
Hi there. I think it's a shame that a hospital would deport an immigrant or anyone in need of care. I think that if someone is a human being in our society who is vulnerable, we owe them our care and our protection because they're human beings and for no other reason. I don't care about their immigration status. I don't care about their age. I don't care whether they're productive, quote, in our society or not. They're human beings who deserve our care.
All right.
And I personally would be happy to pay even higher taxes to care for those people. It's not necessary. If we quit sending all of our funds to fund war and destruction in other countries, we could easily pay for universal health care for everyone on our shores, whether they're legal or illegal.
Okay, thank you, Teresa. Well, there are two different points of view, Deborah and Adam and Rob. And what about that, Deborah? I mean, the caller from Martin County spoke of a situation that was obviously really problematic. Sometimes these deportations go smoothly if, and this is the critical if, families cooperate. But that wasn't the case in Martin County. So what about those two points of view? Can they be reconciled? Deborah?
Well, I don't know. I think they're both kind of right, although I might not have expressed, you know, things in exactly the way they did. I think one of the things that we were pointing out in the stories that we did on this subject is that these extreme cases point up real flaws in these two, you know, troubled systems of immigration and healthcare. And they both need to be fixed. Now, if you fix the healthcare or try to reform the healthcare system without paying attention to part of our resident population here, you haven't fixed the healthcare system, and hospitals are going to have just as much trouble or even more trouble than they have now. It doesn't make much sense. Likewise, if you have an immigration system that essentially permits a large undocumented population to exist in this country and relies on it for its labor, you know, you cannot pretend that they're not here getting into car crashes and having kidney failure.
Yeah. Rob, I'd like to ask you this. You know, there is something a little Dickensian, it seems to me, I think, about these people are here and people pay them to work, many people, and then when they get sick or injured, you know, it makes me think of the Dickensian notion that, well, now you're sort of left to your own devices. It's a gamble. At the same time, yeah, we know hospitals are in trouble.
Well, I think you could almost look at it in a more general. I mean, all of us, legal immigrants who are legal citizens here in the United States, we're at risk for some of the things happening to us. I mean, every day we hear stories of people who do not have enough insurance or even well-insured mm-hmm. people get very sick, who use up their insurance benefits and then sort of treat as uninsured patients and then have to become basically poor to get on Medicaid.
Right, and lose their homes. And
And we have hospitals who have to go through this whole awful situation of trying to get paid for the services that they rented for their patients and how they do that. And so, in a sense, this could happen to all of us. I mean, we obviously, in this particular situation with illegal immigrants, they can deport them, which is awful, and they obviously wouldn't think of deporting us, but it does speak for the drastic need we have for reforming our healthcare system. And as a physician, not an expert in immigration, but as a physician, clearly we have to get everyone access to adequate healthcare coverage. It's just this is just one slight example of the overall problems we're having with our healthcare.
Let's talk to Sam, who's calling from Bloomfield, Michigan. Sam?
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am an emergency physician who treats illegal patients all the time, and I have, you know, mixed feelings about the issue. Number one is, I mean, you have to take care of human beings. You know, this is an ethical issue. As a doctor, I cannot refuse take care of any patients.
But I think we're talking about the stabilization of these people after the initial assault,
I wanted to bring, two points. The hospital is in a very difficult spot. You know, they did everything they can. My two points are, it's a shame that the hospital has to act as, as a state. You know, this is a failure of the system. The hospital should not have to make this decision. And this, you know, I hope the President Obama is aware of this case. And this is, you know, just show you how broken is the legal system, the immigration system.
Right.
It has to be dealt with because hospital now they're taking the law into their hands and doing things which is, you know, it's just, you know, dignifying to the medical to the medical profession and the humanity of the medical profession. The hospitals have to do that, but they have no other choice.
Okay,
but
thank you, Sam. You know, I hear in that, a kind of plea, really, for maintaining a humanitarian system and changing this. And I know that we haven't necessarily resolved that in this hour. But I think that these dramatic cases, like those of domestic cases, highlight a lot of flaws. Adam, this is... your policy area, is there something more that we could do and fast?
Yeah. Well, first, let me just touch on the caller, Bob from Florida.
We've just got a moment here.
Sure. You know, it's not safe to assume that people lining up in an emergency room have a particular immigration status or don't, and it's absolutely erroneous to claim that they're getting free care. That's not what happens. Immigrants get the same bill for services as everyone else. They're just not eligible for Medicaid and other benefits typically. So, you know, the solution really has to look at how people can pay into the system if they can afford to pay into the system so that they have coverage. We're talking in almost all of these cases about people who are working. We're looking at health reform. We should be designing health reform so that anyone who's working in our economy has the opportunity to get affordable health coverage. That would go a long way to addressing this issue.
Well, I want to thank all of you for participating today. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website at onpointradio.org and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Deborah Sontag, Adam Gervich, and Rob, thank you all very, very much. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.